you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hi, I'm Parker Romaine.
I'm George Chen, and you're listening to SupDoc, a show where we discuss documentaries with our guests from the worlds of comedy, film, TV, and more.
We're talking music docs all month long in our Rocktober series. On today's episode, we sat down with legendary comedian Dana Gould.
Dana was head writer for many years on The Simpsons. He created the show Stand Against Evil, and he just released his newest comedy album, Mr. Funny Man, on Kill Rock Stars.
Season 2 of Stand Against Evil premieres on November 1st on IFC.
Dana wanted to discuss the revealing 2004 documentary, Metallica, Some Kind of Monster. Filmmakers Bruce Sanofsky and Joe Berlinger, the duo that made Paradise Lost series about the West Memphis 3, follow members of Metallica as one member quits and another goes to rehab.
The metal titans hire a therapist and grapple with 20 years of repressed anger and aggression and force themselves to rebuild their band. Or, as Dana puts it, it's really a film about marriage.
And now, here is Dana Gould.
Today, our guest is Dana Gould, one of my favorite comedians. Thanks so much, Dana, for coming. Really appreciate it. You've been on SupDoc.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Appreciate you having me on.
You're one of my favorites, too.
The Otto.
I was going to say, you're one of my favorites, too. So.
Oh, thanks.
It's like we're fanning out.
We are fanning out.
The great thing about that is by the end of this, I will no longer be.
Well, how big of a Metallica fan are you?
Not at all, originally.
I was wondering, because I knew you're like, I thought maybe you'd want to do like the Brian Wilson documentary or something.
Yeah,
like
well, that's more to my liking. But, you know, that was what was great about this documentary is I went to see it. It just sounded interesting. I liked the idea of I knew the rough story was a band gets a therapist. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I'll go see that. And I knew Metallica, you know, but I didn't own any Metallica and I still don't. But what was amazing is it's not about Metallica. Some Kind of Monster to me is the best documentary ever made about marriage.
Okay.
It really is. You're in a relationship with someone and you reach a point where that relationship has become untenable.
Right.
But because of external circumstances, whether it's a giant business or a family and children, you have to work through this. Mm-hmm. You don't have a choice.
Right.
And that's really what it's about at its heart is it's about, and like in many a marriage, certainly in terms of mine, when a third party comes in to help you navigate that problem, they often become the source of a newer problem.
Did you get the feeling?
And in dealing with that problem, you unite with your original partner.
Right. Yeah, I totally recognize that dynamic in there. And like to me, I've never been married, but yeah, family. I've been in bands. So like the idea of like, I see the patterns of a family and also like, you know, in the music scene, a lot of people come out of dysfunctional
backgrounds. Yeah, totally. Of course, so, you don't become... you know, it's musicians like comedians. I always say, like, no one has ever said, well, now that I got my shit together emotionally, I'm going to go into bars and beg strangers to love me.
Right. You know? As I was watching this documentary, I kept thinking, man, they all just need a therapist. And then the therapist would pop up, you know, and be like, oh, that's right. He's involved.
Yeah. And then you're like, not this therapist.
But that's also kind of similar. I was thinking a lot about Brian Wilson and Dr. Eugene watching this. And I can't find I Just Wasn't Made for These Times. Like, it's hard to find.
Oh, I have it. I wish you'd asked. Yeah, I have it. Yeah, yeah.
But it's very hard to find. It's out of print. But I did watch Love and Mercy recently, which gets into a lot of those
tells the story
as well. Yeah, from a fiction viewpoint.
Yeah. My friend Andy Paley, who actually produced the album that Brian is recording at the end of that movie, Love and Mercy.
Right. Yeah.
In the movie, it looks like Melinda's producing it, but it's actually someone else. Uh-huh. My friend Andy Paley is producing it, and he has answering machine cassette tapes of Brian calling him in the late 70s, early 80s.
Wow.
And you can hear Landy picking up the extension and listening in.
Whoa.
And it's a lot of late 70s jargon, like, yeah. Hey, did you lay out today? We're going to lay out.
What is that? What is
laying out in the sun? Did you lay out?
Oh, right.
Yeah, that was an expression. What'd you do? I laid out.
Very randomly, I know my friend Richard is the son of Van Dyke Parks.
There you go.
And I asked him, like, has your dad seen this movie? Because there's a guy playing Van Dyke in the movie. And he's like, yeah, he just laughed through the whole thing. He just thought it was all ridiculous. But Paco, we talk about this movie all the time because I always say like Greg Kinnear should have played Brian Wilson.
Yes, was the one part about it that I was not really cottoning onto. But I thought, what's his name? Was
Dano
fantastic.
Did great.
Yeah. Paul Dano was unbelievable. Yeah, he was unbelievable.
When we got this cat, the previous owners...
And Paul Dano should have played him in the second half.
Yeah, they could have just done that.
Yeah.
He put the effort in.
Put a little gray in his hair. And, that was a weird choice.
Speaking of casting, I know we're jumping around a little bit, but this movie, it's based on Metallica. If you don't know what Some Kind of Monster is about. And we like to do a little game on the show where we cast... the biopic version.
Oh, okay.
And we got I came up with two or three. I don't know, Paco, what you've got for yours. But Dana, if you were putting you on the spot a little bit.
Oh, yeah, you are.
If you're casting. Well, then I'll throw out mine. The first one I thought of for Lars Ulrich was Giovanni Ribisi. They kind of have a similar, yelly style.
Yep.
And visually, there's a little bit there, too.
Mm-hmm. Vonnie would be a really good Lars Ulrich. James Hetfield, the guy that plays Thor.
Yeah.
Chris Hemsworth? Yeah.
Chris Hemsworth would be a good, but he'd have to lose weight and get drunky weight. Or Greg Barrett would play it.
Greg Barrett
very good James Hetfield.
Is it because of the soul patch?
The soul patch, and Greg is tortured like Hetfield
and
is tortured.
And from the Bay Area and from a rocker. The Bay Area.
He would, like Greg would not rocker. Mind me saying that.
Yeah.
What about Chris Pratt?
He's tortured.
As James Hetfield.
Chris Pratt?
Chris Pratt would be good. But I know Chris. Chris isn't that dark.
Okay.
Doesn't seem to be that dark. No.
Chris is a hail fellow well met.
My version of that.
I worked
with
him on Parks and Rec. That's how I know Chris.
Oh yeah,
oh, nice.
Did you write on that show?
I wrote on the second season.
Yeah, great show.
Well, we had some people say Aaron Paul for Lars.
Oh, I can see that as well. Aaron Paul. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Aaron Paul would be really good. Aaron Paul would be really good.
Here's my because we asked some listeners how they would cast this. Here's some of my favorite. Brian Posehn is James Hetfield.
He would do it.
I like that a lot of the cast is from my Christmas card list, which I like.
Oh yeah. Doug Henning is Kirk Hammett.
Doug Henning is
Doug Henning.
The magician Martin's, from the 70s.
Yeah. Martin Scarelli as Lars Ulrich.
Oh, geez.
Once he gets out of jail.
Yeah.
And Robert Trujillo is Robert Trujillo.
Yeah. It's hard
Robert Trujillo would play a great Robert Trujillo.
Yeah,
he would. It's a tight cast, but.
Kirk would be. I'm not sure. No one is leaping to mind for Kirk, but.
Yeah,
it's a hard one.
The guy for The Shrink, I would cast.
Oh, The Shrink, yeah.
I'm blanking on his name. He played the robot in Aliens.
He was the star
of the show Millennium.
Yeah, he is a genre guy.
Yeah.
And Robert, Lance Henriksen.
Lance Henriksen.
Yeah,
Lance Henriksen would be a great
I totally shrink. See that.
Yeah.
That is
yeah.
a good call on that one.
Yeah. I like when he's just writing lyrics on Post-its. Push through.
Yeah.
And they start making fun of it.
He's like, yeah. I got to sign up for BMI now.
Yeah. I remember when, and you know, I was married and got divorced, and we did go to a couples therapist.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, this isn't working. And we'd agreed to get divorced. And then we went to a different couples therapist to help us through our mediation because we had three children and we didn't want it to get, we wanted it to stay amicable because it had been. And we sat with our new therapist for about 35 seconds and we turned to each other and went like, oh shit.
Yeah.
Because we knew that had we gone to this guy, we wouldn't have been getting divorced.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah. And by that time, the toothpaste was out of the tube.
Yeah, but, it's hard to put it back in.
Yeah, but we knew. But that's not a lie, and that's not apocryphal. And my ex-wife would say the same thing. Wow. We just looked at each other, and it was like, oh,
the wrong
fuck.
Guy.
Yeah, wrong dude.
Yeah.
What makes
yeah.
a good therapist a good therapist? Like, what was the shining example of? Like, what did this person say that you were like, oh, this?
And like, have we all been in therapy, by the way? In here?
Well, I can only say our the couples therapist that we went to that was not great. We had fundamental differences, and he seemed to have the theory of we really needed to fight them out and get and go work through them. Mm-hmm. Where our second therapist immediately said, like, these aren't differences; these are things that make you different. But that doesn't. But that's not a difference. Right. And he was just like a guy, the drive around guy. Like, you're separate people, but you form a unit, and we're gonna concentrate on the things that help you form a unit. And right. it was just a completely different worldview, and we were
and
just
that was
like,
at
God,
the
that,
point.
That,
is just
no,
a
it was just too late at that point. It was too late at that point. But we were like, God damn it, God
yeah,
damn
you,
it!
You can't glue the broken dishes back together.
Yeah, and that's not apocryphal. And so I really do feel like when I watch this movie, like I so get it. The best scene in the movie, and I wrote a pilot based on this basic premise for FX that Dave Grohl produced with me called Discord, C-H-O-R-D, from the therapist point of view, about a therapist who's a well-known couples therapist who's secretly sleeping in his garage because him and his wife don't communicate, but he can't, he can't let his clients know that, and he ends up working with a band. What I thought was the most telling scene, and what's also very interesting about this documentary is later I have a television show called Stand Against Evil on IFC. Right. The second season premieres November 1st. Get in a plug.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
While you're waiting, you can just download my album on iTunes, Mr. Funny Man. Oh, did that fall out? Anyway, long story longer. On Kill Rock Stars. And on Billboard, it just says... On Billboard, it has the ranking, the label, and the artist. Uh-huh. And so on Billboard, it says, number 3, Kill Dana Gould.
Yeah, that's you need better PR.
I like the message. But long story, Stand Against Evil is produced by the studio, for lack of a better term, is this company called Radical Media that produced Some Kind of Monster. And so I know all of the inside dope. And it was supposed to be a quick, like, half-hour making-of-the-album documentary that they were going to release when the album came out. And then James Hetfield walked in one day, like he does in the movie, and says, hey, I have to go to rehab or I'm going to lose my family, and just up and leaves for 9 months.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
And the guys have to spin their wheels for 9 months. And then he comes back a completely different human being. I mean, he looks different.
Yeah.
He is using
clearer.
Yeah. Using words that they don't like. You're talking about touring and I'm experiencing fear. And Lars always went, who the fuck are you?
Right.
And what's amazing in that scene, and there's so many amazing scenes like this, what's amazing in that scene is Ulrich goes, you used to control this band with your drunken rage and now you control it with your sobriety. And that was so like, yes, yeah, totally. Yeah. That's exactly what's happening.
Is that the 4 p.m. line?
Yeah,
when he's like, let's play a clip from that.
Yeah.
And we'll just throw it back.
It's so amazing.
Yeah.
I just think you're so fucking self-absorbed. And what makes it worse is that you always talk about me. You use the word control and manipulation a lot. I think you control on purpose, and I think you control inadvertently. I think you control by the rules you always set. I think you control by how you always judge people. I think you control by your absence. I think you control all of this even when you're not here. And all these rules and all this shit, man, this is a fucking rock and roll band. I don't want fucking rules. I understand that you need to leave at 4. I respect it. But don't tell me I can't sit and listen to something with Bob at 4:15 if I want to. The fuck is that?
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I was in a band, and around 2002 or 3, when this had come out, we actually did see a therapist as a band, but it was like a complicated mix of things. Like, there were two brothers in the band, and then one of the brothers was dating the singer, and I lived with them. So there was just so much built up.
Yeah, that's a Beach Boys level of internecine right. squabbling.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's like Fleetwood Mac kind of.
But there was nothing at stake. There were not millions of dollars at stake. It was literally just like, well, we all have to hang out anyway, so we might need a mediator.
Right.
Like one guy just stormed
down here.
It was in the Bay Area. And one guy just, we had a show. One member just stormed off. Like, I don't think we had played, and he just, like, the brothers got in a thing, and then he stormed off, and then it was like, we kind of just improvised something through the rest of the set, and then it took, like, a couple weeks for us to, like, be like, I guess we need to, like, meet up and figure things out, because there's just so much, years and years and years of tension.
Sure, and it's also family tension.
It is, yeah.
The craziest story I have ever heard, and I don't know that, I'm not really... under the hood with Fleetwood Mac, although I grew up with... Oh, somebody has a Soda Stream.
Yeah, I love
know
it.
Those, but I have a refrigerator full of those bottles.
Oh,
you might have to
favorite.
Cut this. You might have to cut this out.
No, this is like a plug. It's a plug for Soda Stream. Our new,
can
hopefully
I just
a
say,
sponsor.
Can I say one thing about Soda Stream?
Yeah, sure, definitely.
Pennies a serving. Oh.
Yes, it is.
George,
pennies
a serving.
That's from Trader Joe's. It's pretty cheap. This water.
Do you ever get the Torani syrup and add it to your Soda Stream?
No, what I use, and I'm gonna tell you this now. It's a big secret, so I'm glad you're both sitting.
Exclusive.
Is I get the stevia flavoring from Whole Foods, like stevia cola or stevia root beer, and you put a couple drops in it, and it's like having a Diet Coke or a root beer, and it's completely free calorically, and it's practically free. Again, I'm going to circle around full. Pennies a serving.
And your hips will thank you.
Your hips will thank you. I can see my feet.
I'm out of the soda game. I got a kidney stone a little bit ago.
Oh, and they're just wonder, you good cut for that you.
When Wayne Fetterman was
like
here, we made him
peeing
taste
the something. Head of a ventriloquist dummy, I would think that must be like.
Luckily, I did. I got a wide urethra.
Wait, did you just say, did Wayne Fetterman give you what?
No,
what
Wayne
kidney stone?
When he was here, we made him drink the Rowdy Roddy Piper soda.
Uh-huh.
And he was like, I've never seen They Live. I'm like, that seems strange. I'm surprised.
I can hear Wayne. I've never seen They Live. I don't know this soda, but no, I'll drink it.
He's a wrestler soda shaped like bubblegum. Okay.
What was his documentary?
Oh, he did Crumb.
Oh, that's a great one for Wayne. That's a great one.
Yeah, we should plug for that one. Listen to Wayne talk about Crumb.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
But what I was going to...
therapy.
Say about the craziest thing. I don't really know that much about Fleetwood Mac. I mean, I know everybody was sleeping with everybody, and I think they, I think there might have been drugs and alcohol involved, but I'm not sure.
yeah, maybe just mountains of cocaine.
Yeah, but the craziest level that I ever heard about with the Beach Boys was in the late 70s or early 80s, I guess. Dennis had impregnated Mike Love's daughter, who was also his second cousin.
Right.
And they were still touring.
Oh, right, because they're related. Right, yeah.
Yeah, they're cousins.
Oh,
and
man.
So Mike Love had it that throughout the tour, he would never have to set eyes upon Dennis Wilson. And so there were literally part of the setup for the show was like curtained off pathways and the stage was and the stage was set up so that Mike would never have to see Dennis.
Wow. That's insane.
Did she have the kid is the other question.
I think she did. I don't know for sure, but I know that that happened. Wow. That was like the height of the
They're like, why does the cage look like a paisley? It's like easier for no one to have eye contact.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, and what is also brilliant about that, and this is where I find, this is why I find the Beach Boys more interesting than Metallica. They both come from very dark, savage, emotionally savage places. Mm-hmm. But the Beach Boys looked clean cut and sang fun, fun, fun.
Right, right.
As a way to who else but somebody whose father beat them so hard they went deaf in one ear would write a song called Fun, 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 because you're just yearning for this thing that you can't experience.
Yeah.
Whereas Metallica went, they did what in acting, would they went with the obvious intention. You know, they were angry, so they screamed.
Low hanging fruit.
Being angry, so you instead of being angry, so you smile. That's why I find the Beach Boys takes an interesting turn that you don't see. They're both, they, you know, especially like you see Lars Ulrich, like Lars Ulrich's dad, speaking of Crumb.
Oh, man.
Lars Ulrich's dad looks like Mr. Natural.
Yeah, he does.
And he's just this German, like,
yeah.
Lars Ulrich plays him a track and he's so proud of it and he just strokes his beard and goes, if I were you, I would delete it.
That's the father figure that he comes from. That makes sense.
It makes sense. And then you look at Lars Ulrich and go, yeah, I get it.
He's also like a Danish tennis pro or something. His dad was like an award-winning tennis player. Award-winning, prize-winning tennis player. So
we've
like,
all been to the tennis awards.
They're great. They're really fun. Yeah. So I remember when Patton Oswalt hosted it.
Like that's like that kind of crazy bearded patriarch. Also, their manager is also a crazy beard man.
Yeah,
the guy Cliff Bernstein from Q Prime. I'm like, okay, you found another father figure, and then the therapist is yet another father figure.
Right,
and they keep chucking them, like you know, it's like because the problem is not your father figure. The problem is, you know, the really interesting documentary that has not been made is John Lennon's quest for parental figures. And that was sad and failing. You know, he would find these people once he, you know, became a little self-actualized, he would always search for a savior, a father figure, and then he would love them and then turn on them. And it, first it was like Brian and then Brian Epstein and then Brian died. Then it was the Maharishi, and then he turned on the Maharishi. Then it was Arthur Yanov, who did Primal Scream Therapy. Then it was Alan Klein. Then he turned on Alan Klein. Then it was Arthur Yanov, who did Primal Scream Therapy. Hmm. Like, he was always searching for these people and then turning on them because they let him down, because he had given them an impossible job.
Did he do that to George Martin?
I don't think they did it to George Martin, but it was clearly with, like, Brian Epstein was definitely a father figure. And the other psychological aspect of the whole thing, there's a really brilliant book called You Never Give Me Your Money, which is the psychological breakdown of the Beatles breakup as if it was a divorce. And what you see is, especially with John and Paul, these two guys whose mothers died when they were very young, who became completely codependent on each other, could not leave each other until they had replaced their mothers. Paul with Linda and John with Yoko.
Oh, man.
And then once they had replaced their mothers, they grew apart because they began to self-actualize again.
Whoa.
And of the two in the book, and when you break it down, Paul is vastly more mature than John. And what you see is John doing everything he can to break up the band, short of breaking up the band. And then finally Paul saying, well, fuck it, I'm out. And then John going ballistic because he didn't get to announce it. It's really fascinating. And really, when you look at it that way, the first father figure that John tried to destroy was the Beatles, but he didn't have the balls to do it. Mm-hmm. But he was the first one that brought Yoko into the studio and go, she's with me now, we're one person. Which anybody would say is a textbook bad decision.
Yeah.
And they would always do that, and that's part of our culture, that we have this false belief in a soulmate, that you're going to meet the perfect person and your life is going to be changed and you'll be one person. And our pop culture is littered with songs that are completely wrong. And there's, you know, God only knows what I'd be without you. I can't live if living with is without you. You complete me. All these things are wrong. All these things are psychologically fucked up. And John Lennon specifically made such, you know, he would say, like, Yoko and I are, we're John and Yoko. We're one person. Now, any psychologist would go, flag.
Yeah.
flag on the play. And, you know, suddenly this person that, you know, these guys have been in the most successful band in the history of popular culture. Mm-hmm. And suddenly there's somebody new in the studio offering their opinions as if they're an equal, and they have no
sounds a little bit like someone we see in this film.
Yeah, it's very provocative. And the other, and then he accuses them of being then he accuses them of hating Yoko and of being male chauvinist. It's like, mm-hmm. no, it's because we've been four guys for 8 years, and now we're four guys and a girl. This woman doesn't even play guitar, and I have to take her notes.
Right.
But he couldn't pull the trigger on the band.
It was
finally Paul that announced it.
It's just total, like, sabotage internally, yeah.
What do you think about creativity?
He was furious that he did it. I might have certain facts wrong. I mean, the Beatles breakup is well documented. And mm-hmm. there are also legal reasons that they didn't announce it because Let It Be was coming out or some nonsense. But it is true, just to finish the point. I'm sorry I interrupted you, Parker.
That's fine.
That John and Paul couldn't leave each other until they had replaced their mothers, and then once they had replaced their mothers, they had to leave each other, which is really fascinating. Yeah. And then both of them made their wives musical partners when they weren't up to the task.
Wings, yeah.
Wings and John and Yoko. I mean, like,
I like the John and Yoko stuff, though. I like the release. There's the one Green record I like a lot. Yeah,
Imagine.
Yeah.
But. If the Yoko cuts on Double Fantasy are not the best cuts on that album.
No. and the plastic bands.
Yeah, Yoko Ono is no Paul McCartney.
No, she's like a Fluxus performance art person.
Yeah, exactly, which is great. You know, but it's just fascinating that's how it went down. It was so by the book.
Yeah.
It was so by the book.
Replace the mother figure.
Yeah. George Harrison is like, and then in every family, there was
Kirk Hammett.
There's Kirk Hammett. George Harrison.
Or
in my family of origin, me. Or in the Doors, it was John Densmore, the guy that just silently.
Right. Play drums.
The peacemaker that tries to get everybody to get along.
Yeah.
Gets everybody's ulcer for them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they, mm-hmm. you know, cause I, they internalize
yeah,
everything.
Yeah, I was the guy who suggested therapy for my band. Yeah. And, like,
that's
you know,
funny.
Did a lot of, like, dad stuff in my band.
Sure, sure.
I was the oldest, but still, it's just like, I don't feel like this is what I should be doing.
Yeah, no, it's really, it's difficult. And every, you know, that dynamic exists in every group. Mm-hmm. And Kirk Hammond, you can see the poor bastard's hair falling out. and then his hairline gets lower again.
And grayer.
Yeah, and grayer. But yeah, you can see him having everyone else's ulcer.
Mom and dad are fighting.
Yeah, and he just internalizes it all.
Which is interesting because another thing that sets the whole thing off is Jason Newsted leaving, which
right.
on one level you look at it and you're like, what? You just kind of screwed yourself. But maybe it was the healthiest boundary for him to establish.
I think it is amazing that he just goes, well, I'm leaving.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
and he had butter.
You know, I left The Simpsons.
You know, I was going to say, like, yeah. How,
and my father, who always gives me the worst advice, said, I wouldn't do it. Like every, it's always like, but I'm, my, you know.
But where's The Simpsons now? I mean, you know.
If I stayed there, I would be much, much wealthier than I am now, and I would be much more miserable and probably about 400 pounds.
Yeah. Was it a hard working environment? One of the questions.
No,
so the
it
question
was lovely.
Was
it was beautiful. It was lovely. I loved doing it, but I was really done. And I didn't. You know, I've always had a, just to talk about myself for a moment, I have a TV show and a comedy album out. I like to do other things. I like to perform, and I'm also a writer. And with The Simpsons, it was just that one thing. And I've always been a much bigger fan of me than of the show.
Right, right. But what I was going to ask you is creativity by consensus. It never works, right? I mean, what's your thought on that?
It depends on who is making the consensus. If it's one writer and eight executives, probably not. If it's 12 brilliant writers, it's probably going to be good. The funniest joke in my, the funniest of all the episodes that I wrote, the joke that makes me laugh the hardest.
Yeah.
I not only did not write, I don't know who wrote it. And I think I know who wrote it because I know it's his voice, but it's never been confirmed. I think it was Tom Gamble. And it was an episode I wrote called Papa's Got a Brand New Badge, where Homer starts a home security system like ADT.
Right.
And you know, the thing with writing comedy or writing music is, or writing novels probably more than anything, is you can see where you are in your life by what you're writing about. And at this point, I was newly married. I had bought a house. I was being an adult for the first time in my life. And part of buying a house was we had to get a home security system. And it's like, you were exposed to these things that you'd never be exposed to before. And I thought, that'd be an interesting thing. What if Homer did that?
Right.
So there was a bit in the show where they were doing a commercial for Homer's home security company, which is called Spring Shield. And there's an old woman sitting alone in her apartment, and then a Maurice Sendak like monster walks in, and the woman goes, "Monster!" And then Homer and the home security team comes in and goes, "Never fear, Spring Shield is here." And then the monster looks at Homer and goes, "Friend?" And Homer goes, "You always have a friend with Spring Shield." And he gives him a card, and the monster takes the card and says, "Monster put in wallet." And then the monster takes out a wallet and puts the card in his wallet. And so you also have this, okay, so wait a minute. Is the monster real? Does the monster not know there's a commercial going on?
Right.
and just monster put in wallet is I love so much. I did not think of it, but it's in my episode. But that's a great example of just a great collaboration where it's a bunch of people. You get a lot of great people adding and making things better. So in that regard, it's who makes the consensus. As
well,
they
there's
say, you know, a camel.
There's collaboration,
a
and then you need someone though at the top, don't you, to be like, we need to move on. We got it.
Totally. Or, yeah. That, yeah. Yeah.
That and sucks, that, and that's good.
Yeah. And that's you know, and I'm that guy on my show, so it's sometimes you know it. You know, I've had episodes where, yeah, okay, that's a six.
right.
You know, but yes. But you got to go. You
Stand
get
versus
it on.
Evil, which premieres November 1st, second season.
Yeah, Stand Against Evil.
Oh, Stand Against, yes. Right.
It's Ash versus the Evil Dead and Stand Against Evil. And right. Everybody compares the two. So if you'll indulge me 30 seconds.
Please.
They're both horror comedies starring a gruff guy. And the titles are similar. But I see how people think that it's a ripoff. I can only say that if I was going to rip off a show, I wouldn't then give it a very similar title.
Right.
I would go in the completely opposite direction. This show was in development before Ash versus Evil Dead premiered, which is not to say I love Evil Dead 2. I love Army of Darkness. I love Bruce Campbell and Sam Raimi. I know those. I've met them. I've worked with Bruce, and I love them.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, the hero of Kalamazoo. I love Bruce.
Yeah. Yeah, he's the best. He's the best. But all this was, it's very simple. If you watch my show, it was based on the premise, a very simple premise. What if Dana Scully from The X-Files was partnered with my dad instead of David Duchovny?
That's awesome.
That's That's the show.
Mm-hmm. I love Janet, by the way.
Yeah, she's brilliant. And the title was just a play on the phrase "Stand Against Evil." I changed the character's name to Stand after
so
I thought
Versus
the title.
Doesn't really.
Yeah, but I mean, like, and people go, "It's a ripoff." Like, yeah, well, Winston Churchill and Jim Belushi are both fat guys that smoke cigars, but they're also very different.
That's an apt comparison. I go way back with Janet.
I like the show. I like the show. Janet is. I wrote the part for Janet.
Nice.
I never envisioned anybody else playing that part. And she had to audition for it and came in first, and nobody got near her.
Yeah, and I bet. She's so talented.
Like, yeah.
I did the Plan 9 with you guys at Sketchfest this last year.
Right,
and, it was great to see her again. She and I go way back in sketch comedy here in San Francisco. She's a genius. I love Janet.
Yeah, she is. And she never, ever plays the wrong note. And the show has a very specific tone. And it's scary and it's funny. And she just effortlessly knows where to go. I think the only note I've ever given her was like, "Can you back up 2 feet? Because you're out of your key light there." It's just, I mean, her performances are always just like gorgeous.
Spot on.
Yeah.
And you created it. You're also the showrunner?
Yeah.
And head writer?
Yeah.
Nice. That's awesome.
Yeah. It's only eight episodes, so.
When do you know like when you've got what you're looking for?
Uh-huh. You don't. That's the beautiful thing. It's funny, you know. It's like with the show, what happened with the show, and I my father is a very big personality. I've described him a lot as Archie Bunker without the elegance and sophistication. And he's still around. He's 87. And he is the largest mountain range in my psychic landscape.
Sure. Yeah.
And I wrote a pilot in 2010 based on the premise, what if my dad came and lived with my mother? And boy, there's a Freudian slip. Wow. Let's get the therapist in here right
now. Phil the therapist.
Yeah.
Here's a post-it note.
Exactly. What if my father came and lived with my wife and our kids, with the children, and how these two, like, you know, progressive people with these groovy kids with this very old school 20s, mid-century guy. Fox News watching guy. And I played me in the pilot, and Brian Dennehy played my dad, and
perfect.
He was flawless.
Yeah.
And
Dennehy,
he was brilliant.
Yeah,
and
of course.
The pilot got made, but it didn't get picked up to series. But when I saw it, I was like, all right, well, that character works. Mm-hmm. That character works. And then I just literally thought, well, I want to do something else. And I thought, well, what if I just put him in a show where he didn't belong? And everybody had to deal with him. And then I said, what if you put my dad in the X-Files instead of David Duchovny? And then everybody's fighting monsters and they're all on the same page and you get this guy that doesn't give a shit. But you have to deal with him. And that's the show. It was that simple. Mm-hmm. It was that simple.
That's awesome.
And that was the origin of the show. So it led into itself. So to that degree, like, I knew that the character worked. I knew that the idea worked. Mm-hmm. I didn't know the show was going to work until the first day of shooting, when we had a scene where this old crone demon witch character, she comes into the sheriff's station where Janet works as a sweet old lady. And then Janet looks away and she turns back and she's this hideous demon and she jumps up on the desk and screams at her. And when I saw that in the monitor and the actor Mick Ignis, who played the woman,
she's great.
Yeah, he's great. He's great. It's Mick. It's a dude who plays a lot of our chicks. I know.
Really?
I'm gonna get letters.
Email him, not us.
And a lot of he's a suit actor. There are these guys that work really
like an
amazing
Andy
in suits.
Kind of guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Mick's brilliant. And the minute I saw that work on the monitor, I knew it was gonna work. He was so good, and Janet was so great. I was like, great, okay, if this works. Let's just go. But it's like with stand-up. I thought of a joke the other night. I've been doing stand-up for 35 years, and I still don't know before I try it if it's going to work.
Right. Have you ever tried any lines out on an audience that are for the sitcom that you're like, maybe I should try this line out on a live audience?
No, never that. But I've said stuff on my podcast that just in conversation that I've later said that I could do that on stage. That's almost a bit.
Oh, right.
And they grow into bits that way. But I came up with a joke the other night that I thought like, oh, great, this will work perfectly. Mm-hmm. And it lays there like a turd. And I thought, and it's exciting because you still never know. And it was a good joke. I'm in a relationship now that I hadn't been for a while. And I met her. I've known her for a long time, but I'm in a really great relationship. Mm-hmm. And I said that once you've been single for a long, after being married, when you're single again, your attitudes towards relationships is like a shower on a cold morning. You're afraid to get in, but once you're in, you don't want to leave. And like I thought, yeah, that's awesome. And then I told like three times, the alchemy isn't there sometimes.
Right.
And I've done bits that I thought were great, and the part that I didn't think was that funny is the best part, and the part that I thought that was funny just kind of lies there. Yeah. You just never know.
It's the same as like Twitter. Sometimes you can get like, it just reads well and it looks great and people dig it and you try it on stage and it just doesn't happen. You know, like a tweet.
Or you don't get a lot of, don't get a lot of play.
All my Covfefe material does not work anymore. Like it did that first note.
It's time. It's a shelf thing.
I was talking about guns in my act and to make it work with audiences, you have to say like, I'm not there to, everybody who's in the audience paid to be there and they want to see a show and they don't want to be spoken down to. And so what I have to say is like, I'm not, when I talk about guns, I talk about how people, when they're, that our new national pastime is announcing that we're offended. That's what we're the best at. That's the only thing we make anymore is outrage. And that despite the fact that progressives and liberals are always called snowflakes because they're always offended by things, it's actually the super right wing that get the most offended and squeal the loudest. And you won't find anyone who squeals louder than a gun lover. And then I have to say, I'm not talking about people who own guns and use them. If you own a gun, people own guns to do things that they love. People own guns to go hunting. And I get that. And I do get that. I don't do it, but every member of my family does it. I grew up in a house full of guns. I had a gun cabinet in my bedroom because it was the only room in the house that it fit in. I woke up and looked at 9 rifles in high school. So
and you're from Massachusetts.
Yeah, I'm from the middle of Massachusetts. Everybody in my family but me voted for Trump.
Right.
But I do get those people. I'm not talking about people who use guns to go hunting or to defend their family or their police officer. I'm talking about people who love guns, because loving a gun is like loving a flashlight. And it's really, you have to look at what it means to you.
You can also do that.
Yeah.
Something else.
Yeah, it's called a flashlight. But you have to...
A gun you can fuck. I got a great idea.
My God. That would go...
Jesus.
Yeah.
Let's market that now.
Yeah. Your wide urethra. Okay, never mind.
But the point is, like, you have to allow people to laugh at it. Mm-hmm. And even if somebody in the audience does love guns, you've given them permission to say, well, he's not talking about me, so I can laugh. And then you can make your point. You're not going to make a point by saying, well, you're an idiot and here's why. You make a point to somebody by going, I understand what you're saying. Here's another way to look at it, but I totally get what you're saying. Because people have to be open to your point of view.
Right.
And I mentioned, and this was just part of the setup, and it's true. The other day I tweeted, hurricanes are bad. I'm just putting this here to watch it turn into an argument.
Right.
And it did.
Of course.
Oh, man.
And that gets a huge laugh. Mm-hmm. But it's not a joke. It's just a true observation.
Right.
And it just shows you how we misuse technology. Of course we don't treat guns right because we're just shaved apes. We're just a feral chimp swamp in the universe. Mm-hmm. And that and you know, we used the smartphone was supposed to unite us with our common humanity by putting the world of information at our fingertips. Look how united we are now. And that was the point. But you never know what's going to work. Still, and that's, you know, to circle around to some kind of monster. It's very interesting to see these guys because their band has fallen apart.
Yeah,
and as they're making this album, which is not a good album.
No, I don't think anyone thinks it's.
Yeah.
No, it's widely panned.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they're just eating shit to keep going. You know,
right?
And I get it. Like I, you know, like I've been in the middle. There have been episodes on, you know, The Simpsons or my show. It's like, yeah, this is not one of our best. But the only way out is through, and we gotta go.
Yeah,
it's just so public with them. It's just becoming so public with these guys.
That's sort of the beauty of it too. You know, it's like to use the let it be. Not great. you gotta keep going.
Yeah.
And you know, Pete Townsend said, like, you know, had Keith Moon not died, the Who would have broken up. But Keith Moon dying kept them going because suddenly it was exciting again because they didn't know if it would work anymore.
Wow.
Right.
That's interesting. Like,
and something became at risk. Oh my God, this might not work.
I mean,
let's try it. Yeah.
I mean, well, speaking of, that does bring up like a big thing in the whole Metallica lore is Cliff Burton dying in 86.
Right.
And then like Jason Newsted, I was watching another interview with Jason Newsted, and it was this thing of like, he like auditioned for them like maybe like 2 weeks after they like scattered Cliff Burton's ashes. And I didn't know this, like the only reason they ended up in the Bay Area was like Cliff Burton lived in like El Cerrito.
Oh,
so
really?
They all had to move there. So Kirk Hammett lived in the Bay Area, but like, yeah, the reason they moved to the Bay Area from L.A., I guess.
Lars and James are from down here.
Yeah, started here. So they were and now we know them as like, I'm a Bay Area person. So like, that was like the biggest band out of the Bay Area.
Sure, yeah.
After
yeah.
Journey and then Metallica.
Yeah.
So like, it was
the biggest good band.
Yeah, the biggest good band. So like, that, like.
When the lights go down in the city.
Grew up with all the video, the Journey video game.
There.
Yeah, you were there for a while. You were Boston and then there, right?
Yeah, Boston, San Francisco.
Did you, were you there same time Ron Lynch? Because he did the same.
Yeah, Ron moved into my apartment.
Is this, okay, this is a comedy condo we were talking
about. Yeah, I started the comedy condo.
That was one of the questions that we got.
Yeah, I started
Facebook.
The comedy condo. Me and a guy named Alex Reed, who lives down here, is a TV writer and TV director now.
I think it's finally done, though.
It is done, but we started it in October of 86.
Yeah.
And that was for touring comics or any comic that lived in San Francisco?
It was just our apartment. The first three people in it were me and Alex and a friend of mine from Boston named Laurie Sullivan, who was a waitress that played against Sam's Comedy Club in Boston, who moved out there with me. She was just friends. I dated her roommate for a while. But and then Laurie moved out, and then I moved to L.A., and I think Ron moved in, and then Janine Garofalo lived there a while. Liz Winstead lived there a while, and everybody slept there. John Stewart slept there. I mean, everybody who went through town slept there at some point. And it was this legendary thing. But Alex and I started.
Awesome. Ron about it once, and he said, I think the last person there was John Hoogasian, and then he let it go, and Ron was still like salty about it.
Well, that sounds like both of them.
Yeah, it does. Also, Dan Spencer says you still owe him money for the water bill.
That sounds right. And Danny was my roommate in Boston.
This is a podcast where just grievances from the past come back to you. Just
you
like Metallica.
You lived with Dan in Boston?
Yeah, in Alston, Massachusetts.
Oh, wow.
Glenville Avenue.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
He's great.
I talked to him last week. I love Dan.
Oh, man. He's one of my favorites. He actually introduced me to Barry Crimmins, who I was a huge fan of when I was a teenager watching those Showtime comedy specials. Barry Crimmins used to host them and, like, you know, it was back when, like, Harry Anderson would throw it back to Boston. And
Remember those? Yeah.
And, I love Barry Crimmins. I got to meet him, and I told Barry, I'm like, I know all your jokes. I memorized them when I was a kid. And he's like, let me hear one. And I did a couple of his jokes, and he's like, beer's on me tonight. It was awesome.
That's great. My favorite joke of Barry's, and I say it to people, but I do quote him. Mm-hmm. It's like when people go, like, when you complain about the government and they move. Because then I'd be victimized by our foreign policy.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's on his most recent record. Yeah, that's a great bit.
He did this joke about I got arrested for smuggling books into Kentucky, but I got off on a technicality.
Yeah, nobody could prove there were books.
Nice. Yeah. I love it. Have you seen Call Me Lucky?
Yeah, I'm in Call Me Lucky.
Oh, of course. Yes, that's right.
I'm ubiquitous.
You're in every documentary.
I mean, except for Some Kind of Monster.
I mean, yeah, I'm in every documentary except Some Kind of Monster.
And you said, so the production company you worked with.
Yeah, Radical
Media.
Also,
what were some other behind-the-scenes little tidbits that you got out of it?
Well, they didn't know what was happening. They just decided, and they're brilliant. They made the Nina Simone documentary that was last year. They made Fog of War. They did all Errol Morris's stuff. They're brilliant. And it's
are you the only fiction stuff they do?
I'm their first scripted show.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's amazing. It's funny too because I was ragging on John Lennon, the guy that runs the company. This guy Frank Sherma is very much, he's only a couple years older than I am, mm-hmm. but he's a grown up and I'm a goon.
He's adulting.
Yeah, he adults much better than I do, and I've absolutely made him like a father figure to me. Like I go to him with like, what do I do with him? What do I do about this? Like he's so I totally did that. Mm-hmm. He's like a very much a paternal figure.
Yeah.
But they did not know what was happening, and they were just smart enough to just keep shooting. And mm-hmm. you know, they had to vamp while he was in rehab. But out of that came this amazing stuff, like when Lars Ulrich sits down with Dave Mustaine.
We got to talk about that. That's nuts.
Chilling, and that's like a whole other documentary in and of itself.
Oh yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah, and just the raw hurt in Dave Mustaine, and the Trumpian lack of empathy from Lars Ulrich.
it was nuts because I was like, oh yeah, like I had only watched this for the first time to do this, and I'm like, what the fuck is this scene? How did this happen?
Yeah.
Because the enmity between those guys is like legendary.
Yeah.
And when there's a lot of eye rolling.
It's like Lou Barlow and Jay Mascis getting back together. When that happened, I'm like, what? Yeah. Did hell freeze over?
When you see, when you see Debbie Mustaine talk about like walking down the street and some kid says, you fucking blew it.
Yeah.
He's like, I get that every day. And you can just see the pain and the anger, and if unless I recall it incorrectly, Lars Ulrich just kind of laughs at
him. He kind of rolls his eye. He just does that Lars Ulrich thing where he kind of gets into a little ball and just kind of rolls his eye, and dreaming of tennis.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought what I've been through? I think I've had an awareness of the pain I caused you.
That's not what I said.
Okay.
Do you have any idea
of what I put you through?
What I went through. I mean, people hate me because of you. You know, I walk down the street and I hear some piece of shit say, Metallica at me, and they do that to taunt me. I mean, when I would hear Metallica on the radio, I would be like, God, I have to turn this off because I just keep thinking, I fucked up.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
When James goes back after rehab, that's me when I visit my family. Because I just speak a completely different language than all of them. I've been in I'm in recovery. I'm in therapy. Mm-hmm. And all, you know, so it's just like they never, you completely, like, who are you? What?
Right. And they're like super East Coast. Like,
yeah, super.
Like,
yeah.
Nobody feels like Bob Rock, though, because that's a paid position.
He is an interesting character, though, because he seems okay with whatever happens. Because
he's Canadian.
Well, that might be part of it. He made his money.
You know, I'm in the documentary being Canadian. I'm just saying.
You're from Winnipeg,
I'm
right?
I'm from Massachusetts, but my best friend made it.
Oh, you're being serious.
I'm totally serious. There's a documentary. Oh, there's a really great documentary called Being Canadian by Rob Cohen, who's a writer-director who lives here in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. and it's about the cultural shock of what Canada is and why so many people from Canada are great comedians and just the cultural. It's sort of the global little brother.
Yeah.
And it's awesome. A really brilliant documentary. And there although is so I'm much, not Canadian, I am in it.
There's so much good comedy from there. That's true. Yeah.
Like SCTV and all that stuff. Yeah.
Current, like, comics. I know a bunch of comics from Toronto, and they're like,
they're
killers.
They're kids in the hall.
Because they develop, and then they get down here, and they've got all, like, this
whole
other
it's just
flavor.
The Canada itself has this sort of, like, sheepish little brother attitude but until now, and now they're like, now we're the, like, dad's drunk and he moved, dad left mom and moved in with a waitress from the bar, and they live in a one-room apartment over the drugstore. You know, we're the dad that went crazy, you know.
I smell a pilot.
Yeah, no, thanks.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
But yeah, no, that's really true. It's now Canada's like, Ryan we're Gosling sending Canada to the door now when the bill collectors show up. Canada, would you go to the door? We can't have Dad talk to the bill collectors.
Well, if we ever make a documentary about SupDoc, we'd like to have you be a part of it. But Bob Rock, I'm like, that can't be his name. That can't be a real name. But apparently, like, how do you turn into a rock producer with the last name of Rock? It's like if his last name was like Bob Powercourt or something. You know?
Oh, my casting for him was Cato Kaelin, like now.
Oh, right.
Like aged Cato Kaelin.
Yeah.
Just like, I was just in the back room. I don't know what the fight is about.
I really like him.
I like him too. He has boundaries with people.
He has boundaries with people, and I still remember, I love the line. He goes, sometimes you just got to gut through it. It's like, this isn't happening. It's not happening. You're right. Yeah. But we don't have a choice. We just have to gut through it. And I really admire that. And that's some of the best life advice ever. Like, mm-hmm. I said to somebody not too long ago, I was having a really hard time. You will get everything you want in life if you just keep getting out of bed. And, that's a huge part. Showing up is such a huge part of it.
Right. Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah
it really is.
What's Michael McKean? Who's the guy from Better Call Saul?
Michael McKean.
Yeah, he would be a good Bob.
He would be a good Bob. Okay.
I can see that.
He is a great and one of the coolest guys in the world.
Yeah, I bet.
Super funny, super smart.
Spinal Tap.
He's a music guy. Yeah.
Yeah, he's great. He's great.
Did they play? Did they all play Christopher Guest and all those guys?
Yeah, they all play.
Yeah, Spinal Tap really plays they instruments, play. Right? Yeah, Harry Shearer plays bass. Is that right? Yeah.
Derek Smalls.
Yeah. You know what I was listening to this morning, and I haven't listened to for a long, long time, and it's not as good as Spinal Tap, but it's one of those things that was so big in its day, and now people like kind of don't even remember it. The Blues Brothers.
Dude! And the late Briefcase Full of Blues.
In the late 70s, everybody had that album. In 1978, everybody had Let's Get Small and Briefcase Full of Blues. Mm-hmm. Everybody had those albums.
The Jeff Skunk Baxter,
Steve Martin, Best Fishes poster up in their bedroom, and when you listen to it now, it's like, it's just white guys singing live music. I'd much rather hear the originals of all of these.
Yeah, totally.
Once they made Blues Brothers 2000, I think it just you know after that you're like, let's put this to bed. Mm-hmm.
But somebody, John Landis, who directed Blues Brothers, was telling me, he was talking to someone about the Blues Brothers, and they were looking at the scene where they were singing with either Aretha Franklin or Cab Calloway.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, the Cab Calloway scene. Yeah.
And they said, why did you make this movie? And he said, so you'll watch this. It's not John and Dan.
Right.
you're seeing Cab Calloway. You're seeing Aretha Franklin. You're seeing Ray Charles.
Ray Charles.
Yeah, you're seeing all of these.
There's nothing wrong with the action on this EOPM.
You're seeing all of these people that really that introduced them to a whole other audience.
Sure.
And that was the great thing about that movie.
Yeah.
My favorite thing, which when I asked John about it, is he just shrugged, which is the best answer ever. A car goes off an overpass, and then it's 5 miles above the surface. Like, the car goes over the overpass, and then suddenly it's dropping down from, like, an airplane height.
It is like a goddamn cartoon. Yeah. The whole thing's like a cartoon.
That happening.
That's awesome.
Did John Landis do American Werewolf, too?
Yeah.
Did you talk to him about that?
I did. Well, yeah. We worked together, and that's all I talked to him about, because that's in my top 3-4 movies of all time.
Yeah, that's one of the great. Yeah.
And the tone of American Werewolf, that I stole.
Yeah.
Blind.
That's like the fucking last song comes
Ash vs. Evil Dead is a very similar title. In terms of tone, I robbed John Landis blind.
Like, actually scary and actually funny.
Scary and funny, and the people are funny in the same way that they're funny in American Werewolf. The algorithms of that movie and the algorithms of my show, the chemical theorem of that movie and the chemical theorem of my show are identical. John, if you're listening, I robbed you blind.
Nice.
You get Griffin Dunn in a role.
I love Griffin. Yeah, but I met Griffin Dunn. The party was like, I can't believe I'm meeting you. And I said, you're in my favorite movie of all time. I was like, After Hours. Like, no, American
I think After Hours.
After Hours is awesome.
It's one of my top tens. Irrelevant by the invention of the ATM.
That's true. Like Lyft. You do After the Hours. After Hours with the Lyft. Yeah.
But and by the way, no, this has nothing to do with anything we're talking about, but. Raiders of the Lost Ark and Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Two seminal motion pictures. Came out one after the other.
Yeah.
Both starring Harrison Ford. Arguably his two best movies. Yeah, but you'd have to put Star Wars in there. In terms of screenwriting, Indiana Jones and Rick Deckard are both completely irrelevant to those plots. Indiana Jones's job is to prevent the Nazis from getting the Ark. He fails. The Nazis open the Ark, and the Ark defends itself. Had he not interjected, it is possible that the Ark would have gone straight to Hitler, and then Hitler would have opened it, and the Ark would have killed Hitler, and there wouldn't have been a World War II. So maybe you can say Indiana Jones gave us World War II. Rick Deckard's job is to kill all of the replicants. He fails. The last replicant dies on his own, and Rick takes off.
That's
and we
funny.
Still don't know if he is a replicant or not. It's not made clear in the new film.
Oh, I haven't seen it yet. It's not? Okay.
That's not much of a spoiler because it's possible I missed it.
Right.
But it's a great movie. I loved it. Go see it.
Yeah. Planning on
seeing it. I want to see the new Steven Spielberg doc that's out.
About him?
Yeah.
It's about Steven Spielberg.
Oh, yeah, it's HBO,
is it? It's on HBO. Are you in it, Dana?
No, which is strange because I'm in every documentary. But But
have you guys ever heard Echo Brain?
No, what's
that?
Echo
Jason
Brain?
Newsted's band. That.
Oh, really?
They're playing at Bimbos.
They're playing at Bimbos.
I was like,
and
I recognize the back area of Bimbos and everything.
And that's all a part of the vamping. Like, well, let's go see Echo Brain.
Yeah.
And they're
He leaves. He jets out of there. He like ghosts them. It's awesome.
And then just like watching Lars be frustrated is like hilarious. There's just like endless gifs of Lars getting frustrated.
Yeah.
I love it.
What's also interesting is like, the thing that Lars caught a lot of shit about, you know, in terms of Napster, he was really, he was right.
Yeah, he was.
Right.
You know, it's just one of those things like kill the messenger.
Right.
Lars was completely correct about that.
Well, it was like, you couldn't at that point put the genie back in the bottle. You can't put the toothpaste back in, as it were. But they did. They just had to figure out another way to the entire music industry has changed so much since this thing came out.
Yeah.
And I guess the video industry is on the same path.
Yeah.
Now.
And I have friends who are, I have friends that are professional musicians and they don't, they make, how you doing? Well, if it wasn't for the internet, I'd be doing great.
Yeah.
They go out on the road because that's the only way you can make money.
You have to. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the only way you can sort of monetize your life, your work. But he caught, and there's a lot of people like that caught a ton of shit. But as it turns out in retrospect, yeah, they were right.
Yeah, I mean, NASCAR's right. not around anymore either, is the thing. So yeah. it's like just like everything else, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Spotify.
But it's like, yeah, it's not cool that artists create stuff and then people just take it for free. I did a show, a stand-up show, me and Bobcat, a couple of other people. It was in Austin, Texas. Mm-hmm. And Bobcat's a real good friend. Bobcat, Dan Spencer's old roommate.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
And the host of the show was ridiculing the audience for paying to see movies because you can rip them all on BitTorrent. And you're a moron if you pay for a movie. And then Bob goes on and goes, you know, I make my own movies and I put my own money into those movies. And I just like to say to the host, you're a fucking asshole.
Host is like 27 or something.
Yeah, yeah. The host is famous. I won't say his name. I'll tell you his name off camera, yeah. off mic, because I don't want to embarrass him. But it was like, yeah, actually, Bob's right. You're wrong. You're a fucking asshole.
Yeah. I mean, that's I used hilarious. To do a show.
It's nice when people get paid for their work.
Yeah. I mean, I did a show in the basement of a video store up until like a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
So it's like the whole arc of video stores has gone like so far down. Like,
yeah. There's so
barely any left.
What's still open up there? Is La Video still open?
I think they finally they sold their collection to Alamo Draft House.
Right. Uh-huh.
And there's one by the New Beverly, right?
It's
still there, but I went in there and it was just dead.
Yeah.
So dead.
Yeah. Yeah, nobody.
Cinephile, is that Cinephile? Yeah.
I wanted to get a DVD of the first season of Stand Against Evil, and they were like, a what? You know?
You're like, did you manufacture it? They didn't manufacture them. They won't do it.
No, it doesn't move. They just.
Yeah.
I don't have a physical copy of my new album.
Didn't they make any physical copies of this one?
Yeah. I said, do you want copies? Do you want a CD run that you can sell on the road? And I go, no. I'm not Mr. Haney from Green Acres. I don't like to open up a little
trench
store after.
Yeah.
But I would like a vinyl. Like I like the vinyl. I like a tangible thing.
Kill Rock Stars will make a cassette for you.
Or a DVD or like I'd like a vinyl.
Did you do
release.
Video of this of the set? Is there a video of the set?
No.
No, no, no.
Just
okay, yeah.
and that was a creative decision. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, material, I guess it's the same with songs, and you would be able to tell me better than I would know, is that, you know, you can feel when a batch of material is sort of ripe and ready to go, and then it's going to start to rot.
Yeah.
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 And this hour of material was at its peak of perfection, I felt. And I was getting ready to take the summer off and go to Atlanta and do film Stand Against Evil.
You film in Atlanta? Uh-huh.
And we approached like a couple production companies to do the special, and they said, well, we can't do anything until the next quarter, which would have been in... I would have been making it around now. Mm-hmm. And I just like, it's not going to be good.
Yeah.
And then my agent, who's... my stand-up agent, who's a really talented guy, a great guy named Sylvia Lund, said, well, I know these, I'm connected with this record label, and let me hook you guys up, and we'll just do it as a record. And it was the best thing ever.
Awesome.
Yeah, I love working with them. I think they're fantastic. It's a punk label. I feel comfortable there. I kind of feel like, yeah, this is my spot. And
find your home.
And I don't care about it not being a special. People don't watch specials more than once or twice, but you'll listen to an album a lot, you know?
Right.
Like
that's true.
Like, I'm a giant George Carlin fan. I think his last special was one of his best. He's 72 years old, and we know now he's dying. Like you can see him slowing down. Mm-hmm. You can see him slowing down. But the material on that album is among the best of his career. And I have the special and I have the album. Mm-hmm. I never watch the special again. I listen to the album every couple of months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And because of Sound Exchange, you can actually monetize your album.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Where you can't really monetize your special.
Well, I was thinking about it because I have listened to it and like you have like the JFK chimpanzee bit, and I'm like, I know there's a visual here that I'm missing.
Yeah, there's a visual there. Yeah. Like, there's a visual.
You used to have a JFK Jim Morrison bit,
yeah,
too, didn't you?
Yeah. I swap it out.
That's a, just swap
it out.
Because I remember that. I remember, was it Dennis Miller show?
Yes. On YouTube. That's actually, if you put my name into YouTube, that's one of the first clips that come up.
Mm-hmm. Is the Dennis Miller show. Doing the,
yeah, and here's the cool thing about, here's the cool thing about that.
Mm-hmm.
Dennis Miller had a late night talk show in the early 1990s.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Stuart Copeland, right? Yeah.
Yes.
The lead band leader.
Right. And I was on it because I knew Dennis, and Dennis's head writer, a guy named Kevin Rooney, was a really good friend of mine. Mm-hmm. Still is. They both are. So I did the show, and the next night, the Pixies played, and they were pimping Trompe Le Monde. And I was a fan of the, so I get, I said, can I come back tomorrow night and watch the Pixies? Yeah. So if you watch the Pixies playing Trompe Le Monde in the Dennis Miller show, I'm right behind the curtain, like 15 feet away from them, watching them play Planet of Sound.
Oh, and it was great song.
I was like,
song.
So and I was just like, I was right there. Yeah. I was like, this is so great.
Boston too, right?
Yeah. I used to see them at the Paradise for a buck.
When you were in San Francisco, you never saw Metallica or anything like
that.
No. Did you go out to see music? Because I found when I started doing stand-up, I couldn't go out. It's nighttime. You can't go out.
Well, I'm always working.
Yeah.
And if I have a night off, I tend not to. Like, my friend, do you know April Richardson?
I know the name.
She's a really, really funny comedian and a good friend of mine. And she goes out to live music like every night. She's seeing bands. Mm-hmm. She just loves it.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I'm tired.
My attention span was kind of destroyed by stand-up, too. I'm like, oh, you're going to go for longer than 12 minutes?
Yeah,
I don't know that I can do this.
No.
Is Philip Glass playing? I don't know. I can't really handle this.
Oh, God, Philip Glass. But yeah, I'm going to see... I just got tickets to see somebody, but it's I'm going to see Morrissey at the bowl on the 10th.
Yeah, you do a Morrissey too, don't you?
Yes. JFK and Morrissey. Why haven't I done that?
Why the combination of the two? Because Berliners are not vegan. Yes.
Why you're sad?
We land on the moon because it's hard. I am human I need to be loved just like everybody else does. Yeah. There you go. It's all done.
It's done. Wrap it up. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, that was. We all remember JFK's speech about the civil rights distress in the South. There is panic on the streets of Birmingham.
The Birmingham. Nice.
Nice. See what I did there? I did that? In real time. You saw that in real time.
Yeah.
It's
perfect. Panic
you're a professional.
On the streets of London.
We have some fans who've asked some questions.
Yeah, that's really funny.
Of you.
We got some listener mailbag to close it out.
We have listener mail because we gotta wrap this up, unfortunately, because you have to go.
I have to be at my other job, which is a school bus.
Yeah, you're a kid delivery vehicle.
Just like James Hetfield watching your daughters.
Yeah. This morning, I had two kids and three dogs and a Prius.
Oh, Jesus. Yep. Wow. Where would you put the dogs?
They're all over.
Just in between the children?
They're all over me. They're everywhere. It's probably very illegal what we did.
Okay, first question. Would you consider getting into politics?
Nope. I've rented too much porn.
That's not a barrier anymore.
There's a groaning. Yeah, that's true. Like it's like all that is off when you look at what the president now is. Yeah, what does it matter? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just don't think I can change it. No.
What did you like better, working on The Ben Stiller Show or The Simpsons?
Well, I guess.
Shorter, for sure.
The Ben Stiller Show was shorter. I was younger.
Right.
Yeah.
But.
That's where I got the Otto. Like, I loved that character, by the way. The Cupid. Yeah.
Yeah. I think probably The Simpsons, just because The Ben Stiller Show was like. The Ben Stiller Show was my college. Like I went to college, but I was just doing stand up all the time. I didn't really have a traditional college experience like people did, or like the people around me did. I was in the middle of it, but I was going off every night doing stand up in places. I didn't give a shit about parties. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to San Francisco, then I moved to LA, and that was really my college experience. Like all of those people on the Ben Stiller Show, Janine and David and Bob and Ben and Andy, those are like my college friends. Like those are the people I grew up with. And then when I did The Simpsons, it was like my time to adult. Mm-hmm. I was married. I my wife and I bought a house and we had kids, and we get up in the morning and I drive my car to work, and I had a parking pass and an office, and you know, that was a very, that was a really nice, sedate time in my life that I look back on very, very fondly. Mm-hmm. And but it also had to end.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And you got to work with George Meyer, who
Meyer got me my job.
Oh, yeah, really?
I wouldn't have been there if it wasn't for George. Yeah.
And I've only heard legendary stories. They're all about true. George Meyer.
I'll tell you the best George Meyer's, the story that shows you how brilliant George Meyer is. We were pitching on a bit where Homer fell off the top of a building and he hit a awning and then went from like an awning to a flagpole to a thing and then bounced into a dump truck, and we just didn't know. It's called a Rube Goldberg.
Yeah.
And we did not know how to end it. And it was late and everybody was in the room. There's like 18 people in the room. Everybody looking at the ceiling, nobody knowing how to end it. And it was one of the great dead ends of my tenure at the show. And we're just staring and staring and staring. And we've already done popcorn. We've already done popcorn and we've done all the bits. And then George goes, and I'm talking like 40 minutes of a lot of very skilled people staring at the ceiling. And George goes, "What if he lands in a dump truck that's full of marshmallow fluff and he's safe? And then after a beat, a bunch of scorpions come up out of the fluff and start stinging him."
Did you guys go with that?
I think the bit ended up getting cut, but it was like nobody in the room said, "Oh, you thought of that first." Like nobody, was like, "Well, there you go." Yeah,
that is awesome. Yeah.
And my other favorite, favorite George Meyer memory is, you know, when you're writing comedy, you get very heated and you get emotional about stuff, and you have these very serious arguments about these utterly ridiculous things. And I remember once George said, in a fit of pique, and he was deadly serious, "Look, nobody wants cargo pants in this punchline more than me."
The stuff that comes out of the business of comedy is always can be very, very funny. Yeah, you know, when you're pitching shit and it's like, "I can't believe we just had this argument about this gay elf and what kind of hat he
wears." Yeah. That's the beauty of it.
That is the beauty. Dana, thank you so much for being on our podcast.
Oh my God, thank you.
We really appreciate it. This has been awesome. You can hear Mr. Funny Man on Kill Rock Stars. You can see Stand Against Evil November 1st, I believe, the second season premieres.
Yeah, and the first season is on Hulu now, and the second season premieres November 1st on IFC. Yeah.
And you're at the San Francisco Punchline in December, I believe, December 14th.
Yep.
So you go see him. I'll be there. I'll check that out. Thank you so much, Dana.
Thanks a lot, Dana.
Thanks, my pleasure.
Thanks for listening.
You can find more episodes of SupDoc, show notes, updates, and more at supdocpodcast.com.
We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at SupDocPodcast.
If you have comments, corrections, or want to suggest a documentary, email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.
The show is listener supported. You can donate to the show at patreon.com/supdocpodcast.
If you can't donate financially, please subscribe, comment, or tell a friend about SupDoc.
We'd like to thank Documentary News for their ongoing support.
SupDoc is produced by Will Scoble.
Our theme music is by David Siegel.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.